Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. You can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, Radio Havana Cuba, and Sputnik Radio. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. There is a movement to charge people who are responsible for environmental destruction with ecocide before the International Criminal Court. Marie Toussaint is a European parliamentarian and an advocate for equating ecocide with genocide. Indigenous Brazilians clashed with police outside Congress, where a bill removing their land rights was being finalized. The United Nations recommended that the Great Barrier Reef be protected as a World Heritage Site. 1 million people face starvation in Madagascar. Palestinians are protesting a new Israeli settlement in the West Bank. Germany and France have proposed a European Union summit with President Putin, and 9 Catalan separatist leaders were released from prison. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The growing movement to put acts of environmental destruction on a par with war crimes and genocide. An increasing number of activists, lawyers, and politicians want what they're calling ecocide to be punishable by the International Criminal Court. They say making this a crime would deter companies and governments from harming the environment. Instead of paying fines and compensation, offenders would be liable to arrest, prosecution, and imprisonment. Well, Marie Toussaint is a lawyer and advocate for criminalising ecocide, as well as being a member of the European Parliament for the Greens. What sorts of things are we talking about when we talk about ecocide?
What we see now is that there is an acceleration of the destruction of natural resources, an acceleration also of climate change, of the loss of biodiversity, the sixth extinction of the species. So when we talk about ecocides, we talk about these long-term crimes that are really destroying our planet, and we also talk about the gravest damages caused to the environment, like large oil spills, for instance, or large pesticide use, which are killing both the ecosystems and human beings.
And what difference do you think that changing the law in this way would make?
There is a large impunity of both corporate leaders and heads of state leaders. One of the examples, the most famous, is, of course, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who are leading activities that are leading to the destruction of the planet. This is why we need urgently a new law to condemn those crimes, in order to prevent them from happening. And this is real urgent if you want to save the planet.
If this law was passed and was on the ICC statute, then someone like, for example, Jair Bolsonaro would be able to be taken in front of the ICC and charged with ecocide. That's the sort of thing that you're looking for.
Yes, but you know, the first thing about defining ecocide as an international crime is to have the means to prevent those crimes from happening. So when you condemn a crime like grave damages to the planet and the environment, then you also give the international community the means to prevent it, to prevent this from happening. So this would be the world which we envisage.
The planet's biggest polluters, the United States and China, are not signatories to the ICC. So you would only be catching the little people rather than the big polluters.
No. Well, what we will have is a proposal of a definition of ecocides under the form of an amendment to the Roma Statute of the ICC. But this definition can be used throughout the world in every single country. Right now, ecocide is already in the law of 10 countries. Vietnam, where there was the use of the orange agent by the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War, which is one of the biggest ecocides, but also in 9 countries from the ex-USSR. And we are currently discussing the recognition of ecocide in Belgium, in France, where I come from, in Sweden, in Bolivia, in many places of the world. This definition is a definition that we can share throughout the world. We recognize it in each one of our member states, even at the EU level. And then we have this, you know, international crime recognized further than the ICC that we can all use together. And this is really a battle that needs to be led throughout the world altogether.
Thank you so much for outlining that for us, Marie Toussaint, member of the European Parliament for the Greens.
In Brazil, indigenous protesters armed with bows and arrows have clashed with police outside Congress. The violence forced the suspension of a debate on a controversial land reform bill. Campaigners say the bill will open protected reserves for mining, dams, and development. At least 2 protesters were hurt in the fighting. The United Nations Scientific Committee has recommended the Great Barrier Reef be added to a list of endangered World Heritage Sites. The UN body blamed a decline in coral on climate change and urged Australia to take accelerated action. That's prompted an angry response from Australia, which has been trying to keep the reef, a major tourist attraction, off the in danger list.
Communities in Madagascar are on the verge of starvation after the worst drought in 4 decades devastated the south of the island. The World Food Program says more than 1 million people could be affected. The group estimates that nearly $80 million is needed to fight the crisis.
Palestinians have protested against a new Israeli settlement in the West Bank. They burned tires and set off firecrackers close to the town of Nablus. The area has seen multiple demonstrations. Israeli settlements in the West Bank are illegal under international law.
Germany and France are proposing an EU summit with Vladimir Putin this morning in Angela Merkel's final speech to Parliament. She emphasized the need to resume talks. So what can we say about that?
The events of the last few months, and not only in Germany, have clearly shown that it's not enough for us to react to Russia's numerous provocations in an uncoordinated way. Instead, we must create mechanisms to be able to respond to provocations together and in a unified way. Only then will we learn to counter Russia's hybrid attacks. In my view, we, the European Union, must seek direct contact with Russia and the Russian president. It's not enough for U.S. President Joe Biden to speak with the Russian president. I welcome that, but the European Union must also create formats for dialogue. Otherwise, conflicts will never be resolved.
Angela Merkel speaking there.
9 Catalan separatist leaders walked free from prison on Wednesday, vowing to win independence from Spain. Their release came a day after the 7 men and 2 women were pardoned for their role in staging a banned referendum on secession from Madrid. The Spanish government said the measure was a necessary step towards national healing.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com. On to NHK World Radio Japan. The Japanese Prime Minister restated a goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Britain continues to move toward joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership. China is upset by U.S. offers of 2.5 million COVID vaccines to Taiwan. The United States has banned the import of key solar panel materials from China over allegations of forced labor. The Chinese government has forced the closure of the pro-democracy newspaper Apple Daily in Hong Kong. In his first speech, the Iranian President Raisi called on the United States to lift sanctions against his country and revive the nuclear agreement. NHK Japan.
Japan's Prime Minister has stressed the importance of achieving the government's goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. Suga Yoshida made the comment during a task force meeting to discuss how much progress has been made toward reaching the UN's sustainable development goals. The targets include eradicating poverty by 2030 and integrating climate change measures into national policies. Japanese officials say more renewable energy is being used in the country, but cite private sector experts who say the increase is still not enough to achieve a carbon-neutral society.
Britain is moving yet closer to joining a vast trade bloc in the Asia-Pacific region. Officials in London say they are starting negotiations on Tuesday to enter the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said membership would open up unparalleled opportunities for British businesses and consumers. The country applied in February to join the trade agreement. 11 member nations, including Japan, responded earlier this month by agreeing to launch task forces to hold negotiations for Britain's entry. London is trying to build economic ties with regions outside Europe following its exit from the EU. It has positioned trade with the Asia-Pacific region as the pillar of that strategy. The British government says its exports to CPTPP member countries will increase by 65% by 2030.
China is increasingly frustrated by deepening ties between the U.S. and Taiwan over vaccine aid. China's foreign ministry has denounced the U.S. for supplying Taiwan with 2.5 million coronavirus vaccine doses.
We urge the U.S. side not to seek political manipulation in the name of vaccine assistance and stop interfering in China's domestic affairs.
Zhao said Taiwan's Democratic Progressive Party has blocked Chinese-made vaccines despite Beijing's offer to help. He also accused Taiwan of neglecting the lives and health of its people. The Moderna vaccine from the U.S. arrived in Taiwan on Sunday. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen expressed gratitude, saying the United States has provided a helping hand at a time of difficulty. The United States has expanded a trade blacklist on Chinese goods to include firms that produce materials for solar panels. It cited their involvement in the alleged abuses in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. The U.S. Commerce Department suspects the five firms were involved in human rights violations against Uyghurs and other ethnic minorities. That includes forced labor, detention, and high-tech surveillance. China is the world's largest producer of solar panels. Many nations have relied on the country as they transition to renewable energy. But industry analysts say a large amount of polysilicon used in solar panels comes from Xinjiang. The news follows a January ban on the import of cotton products suspected of being made through forced labor in Xinjiang.
We begin this hour with news that's sending a deep chill through Hong Kong. Pro-democracy newspaper Apple Daily, which many revered as a beacon of media freedom, has printed its last edition. The newspaper was forced to stop publishing after some of its assets were frozen and senior staff were arrested for allegedly breaking the new national security law. At a newsstand in a downtown area, people formed a line several hundred meters long to buy the last paper.
The newspaper that tells the truth is now gone.
The end of Apple Daily means the end of freedom for newspapers.
Several hundred people gathered in front of Apple Daily's head office on Wednesday night to show their support for reporters putting out the final edition. The closure comes after mounting pressure from authorities. On Wednesday, a lead writer at the paper was arrested on suspicion of violating the national security law. Five of its executives were arrested last week. The newspaper harshly criticized the governments of China and Hong Kong. That made it a thorn on Beijing's side and gained it a lot of public support after 26 years in print. But many say the shutdown is a sign the rights guaranteed for Hong Kong are being greatly diminished. In a statement, British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab criticized Hong Kong's government. He says the forced closure of the newspaper by authorities is a chilling blow to freedom of expression in Hong Kong. Apple Daily said it published 1 million copies of the last edition. That's about 1/7 of Hong Kong's population. The front page featured a picture of supporters waving in front of its headquarters with the headline, Hong Kongers bid a painful farewell in the rain. The newspaper's webpage went offline at midnight on Thursday. Apple Daily then put out a message to its supporters. We would like to thank all of our readers, subscribers, advertisers, and Hong Kongers for your loyal support. Good luck and goodbye.
Iran's president-elect has called on the United States to lift sanctions on his country in his first press conference since winning Friday's election. Ebrahim Raisi spoke to reporters on Monday and referred to negotiations between Iran and the U.S. aimed at reviving a landmark 2015 nuclear agreement.
It is the United States who broke the nuclear deal. It must lift all oppressive sanctions imposed on the Iranian people.
Raisi also ruled out the possibility of meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden or holding negotiations over Iran's ballistic missile program. The conservative hardliner Raisi is scheduled to take over as president from the incumbent Hassan Rouhani in August. His main challenge will be to restore the country's economy, which has been crippled by the sanctions.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan. They are now heard from 9:30 to 10 p.m. at 7245 and 7355 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. For the 29th time, the UN General Assembly voted to end the UN embargo against Cuba, 184-2, with only the U.S. and Israel opposing the resolution. Mexican indigenous leaders and Zapatistas arrived in Spain by boat to mark 500 years of resistance. U.S. youth environmentalists marched 400 miles to protest at Ted Cruz's Houston home. The Brazilian Congress voted to privatize the National Electric Company. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The international community once again overwhelmingly stood behind Cuba's plight, demanding the lifting of the six-decade-long U.S. blockade on the island. For the 29th occasion, the UN General Assembly voted the resolution necessity of ending the economic, commercial, and financial embargo imposed by the United States of America against Cuba. The resolution was adopted by 184 votes in favor, 2 against from the United States and Israel, and 3 abstentions. The vote originally stated for last year was postponed for a later date by Cuban authorities due to the restrictions imposed by the COVID-19 pandemic. The adopted text once again reiterates its call upon all the states to refrain from promulgating and applying laws and measures that breach international law and multilateralism. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez Parrilla recalled on Wednesday the brutality U.S. blockade now reinforced at a time of the pandemic. Addressing the UN General Assembly to present a resolution requesting the end of the six-decade-old measure, the foreign minister said the rules adopted by the Trump administration were similar to those adopted in time of war. Those actions, he added, have remained unchanged since President Joe Biden was sworn in, despite his presidential campaign promises to the contrary. The Caribbean island's top diplomat asserted that the damage caused by the U.S. blockade is incalculable. No Cuban family has escaped the effects of this inhuman policy amid the pandemic. It has deprived the island of accessing technology, devices, treatment, and appropriate drugs. Rodriguez reiterated that the blockade is a massive, flagrant, and systematic violation of the human rights of the Cuban people and that it constitutes an act of genocide. He said it was an economic and extraterritorial war waged against a small country deprived of vital revenue news due to the global recession and financial crisis caused by the pandemic. The minister added that the U.S. has cynically attempted to sell the idea that the Cuban system is failing and that its government is inefficient in dismissing the impact of its coercive measures on the Cuban people.
A group of indigenous leaders and members of Mexico's Zapatista movement have arrived in Spain to mark 500 years of indigenous resistance after Spanish colonizers settled in the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan, which later became Mexico City. The Zapatistas sailed across the Atlantic Ocean for a month after departing Mexico in early May. Their boat depicted a big white sign with the phrase, "Wake Up," written in red letters in Spanish. During their trip, the indigenous leaders plan to tour Europe and share their plans to fight the inequities triggered by capitalism. In the United States, climate youth activists and members of the Sunrise Movement ended their 400-mile march from New Orleans to Texas. They gathered outside the Houston home of Republican Senator Ted Cruz, a committed climate change denier. At least 8 protesters were arrested. 19-year-old climate activist Ishan Gupta said in a statement, quote, "Biden, I voted for you because I thought I was securing my future. But every day since inauguration, I've woken up with the same fears. Deliver on your promises so I can have a future doing meaningful work like fixing our power grid." In February, millions of Texas residents faced a massive blackout and freezing temperatures after the state's power grid collapsed. At the time, Senator Cruz decided to travel to Cancun, Mexico, to escape the winter cold. Brazil's lower house of Congress on Monday approved a bill allowing the privatization of state-controlled energy company Eletrobras, sending the measure to President Jair Bolsonaro for his signature. The government-proposed bill would privatize Latin America's biggest power utility by floating shares on the stock market, with the state relinquishing control by diluting its 61% stake. The privatization bill passed by a vote of 258 in favor, 136 opposed, and 5 abstentions. The congressional move to privatize Eletrobras met with strong opposition from popular sectors across the country. They say electricity prices will be pushed up and coming at a time when Brazil is facing the threat of electricity rationing due to the worst drought in nearly a century. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva warned about the privatization of Eletrobras, which may risk the country's energy sovereignty and security. Da Silva denounced on Twitter that Bolsonaro will sell the company, quote, at the price of a banana, and is, quote, just another crime against the Brazilian people and the future of our country, adding that privatizing Eletrobras means delivering an invaluable legacy on a silver platter.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but podcasts are not being updated. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 5 p.m. to 11 at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report, or could assist me by supporting this listener-funded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. Please help me keep producing this freely distributed weekly radio show. We will conclude with Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi spoke with journalist Anthony Lowenstein about Julian Assange. The Biden administration is continuing the Trump effort to extradite Assange, and Anthony says the silence of the mainstream media is shameful and hypocritical. Sputnik Radio.
Today marks 9 years since WikiLeaks founder and publisher Julian Assange sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. You can watch our interviews with him on our YouTube channel. Today, according to the UN, he is being tortured in London. In a week when even concerned so-called mainstream media like CNN met with the Department of Justice about press freedom in the United States, and as UK-US-EU armed Israel bombed Gaza, so recently the site of the destruction of AP and Al Jazeera. I'm joined from Sydney by independent journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein, who has been in East Jerusalem for the best part of the last decade. Era, this studio, Julian Assange, 9 years today that he sought political asylum. What do you make of the Biden administration's continued attempts to extradite him for a 175-year sentence, potentially, and Merrick Garland, the DOJ's decision to keep that up? I mean, has it been successful? Will it deter publishers and journalists?
It's a good question. I guess I'll answer that in two ways. I think for a lot of mainstream media outlets, with a few notable exceptions, their shameless silence speaks volumes about how they view Assange. They view him as problematic, as not worthy of support. And that's deeply wrong, because Assange is someone who I know. I'm not best friends with him, but I've known him for a number of years. He's Australian, as many viewers will be aware. And as an Australian citizen myself, he has an Australian passport. He's not an American citizen. And Australia is essentially, well, what's the polite way to say this on television? Has essentially given up on him. They don't care that he could rot in prison or indeed die in prison. The Biden administration response shows that there's no difference with the Trump administration response. Obama administration, with all its faults, and there were many, made a decision years ago, as your viewers may remember, that it was not worthwhile prosecuting Assange, because they were therefore have to prosecute some of the publications in which WikiLeaks documents appeared. I mean, as a journalist myself, an investigative journalist who's worked across the world, who's written other books and films, there is no more essential news gathering organization than WikiLeaks in my adult life, bar none. In documents about Guantanamo, Iraq, Honduras, the drug war, I mean, any issue you can imagine, any journalist who's serious will use and quote and appreciate WikiLeaks releases. To me, the shameless continued incarceration and torture of Assange in a London prison, with no clear indication of when, if ever, he'll ever be released, is not just shameful, but actually deeply corrupt. And what is so remarkable, although not, is how silent so many journalists are about his case. It speaks volumes about how they see their role. And to me, as I've thought for a number of years, most journalists, if you ask them, will say, yes, we all believe in holding power to account. No. What most journalists want to do is be close to power. That's how they see their job. So when someone like Assange, or Snowden for that matter, or others, are bravely releasing information, taking personal risks, showing us how the world actually works, you get a real sense of what kind of people they are, not just journalists, but people, with how they come down on issues like Assange and Snowden and other sort of major leaks. So I am unsurprised but appalled with how Biden has taken this. There's still time for change, and he's only been in power for 6 odd months, but the indications are not good. So pressure is needed, including, I might add, importantly, in the U.S., by major news organizations who actually benefited and profited from his releases, and Chelsea Manning's, of course. So we're talking the New York Times, Washington Post, and others, who, with a few notable exceptions, have remained remarkably silent about the Assange case.
Well, the Australian government says it's doing what it can. Angie Lowenstein, thank you.
That excerpted interview was by Afshin Ratansi from his program called Going Underground, which is heard on Sputnik Radio, the current name for The Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for the show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please take a moment and make a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 25th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.